Genesis 20, the 22nd talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on September 23, 2001 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2001. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
He and his, let me see exactly what it says. Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maids so that they bore children. For the Lord had closed fast all the wombs of the household of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. So when Abraham prays for Abimelech later on, it says that God heals Abimelech. The rabbinic interpretation of what's going on here is that God afflicted Abimelech with a temporary impotence, and that what happens at the end is that God removes that. Whether that's the case, I don't know or not. But in any case, God did in some way keep Abimelech from approaching Sarah. So he has not had sex with her. But his defense has two parts. One is, would you slay a righteous nation? Now my translation says, in verse 4, Lord, wilt thou slay a nation, even though blameless? Why he says nation, I don't know. Because all God has said to him was that you're a dead man. He didn't say that it would extend beyond Abimelech, the punishment would extend beyond Abimelech. Abimelech must be, he either thinks that by destroying the king, he is bringing judgment down on the whole nation, or that God intends it to be a more widespread judgment that would take place. I don't know which it is. But later on, God says, if you don't return her, I will slay you and everyone with you. So there God clearly is extending it. Then the other point in this statement is, it says, wilt thou slay a nation even though, and my translation says, blameless. But in the margin, it's righteous. Well, the use of the word righteous here is interesting because that's the word that Abraham had used when he was negotiating with God with respect to the fate of Sodom. Abraham's point back there was, yes, Sodom is a wicked civil culture. It's a wicked society. But there are righteous people down there. It would not be like you. It would not be consistent with your character and your values to wipe out the righteous along with the wicked. So his point is, it would not be like you, God, to punish righteous people. And here Abimelech is making the same appeal. He's saying, it would not be like you to punish the righteous. And God has already demonstrated that he agrees with that. When he, in his negotiations with Abraham, Abraham got him down to 10 people. If there are 10 righteous in Sodom, God agreed that he would spare the city. As it turned out, there weren't 10. As it turned out, God saved all of the righteous that there were in Sodom before he destroyed it. And I think that that adds up to one. But he did save the one righteous. So God is committed to that principle. God does want to save the righteous. So that's Abimelech's first appeal. His second appeal is, how could I have known? Abraham said they weren't married. Sarah said they weren't married. How was I to know? And he argues that if he had done any evil, it was out of ignorance. because what he did was an act out of a pure heart and clean hands. So those are the bases on which he appeals to God to be spared from the death that God says is he is worthy of. And God's response is, I know you're blameless. I know you have a pure heart and clean hands, and that's why I prevented you from having sex with Sarah. That's why I minimized then the damage that would be done here as a result of your ignorance. But if you have a pure hand, if you have a pure heart and clean hands, then you will want to do what I ask you to do, and that is return Sarah to her rightful husband. And he points out, Abraham is a prophet. And that as a prophet, Abraham can intercede on his behalf. Now, when we think of a prophet, we usually think of someone who speaks for God. But prophets also have another role, and we see prophets using this other role, and that is interceding to God on the behalf of people. So one role of prophets is to communicate from God to man, but the other role of prophets is to intercede on the part of man to God. And we certainly see that role being played out by Moses, who on several occasions pleads for God's mercy on the part of the people. Well, Abraham here is, it has been pointed out to Abimelech that Abraham is a prophet of God. And as a prophet of God, he can intercede for Abimelech. And God instructs Abimelech to return Sarah to Abraham and ask for Abraham's prayers on his behalf. Abimelech then responds to God. Let's see. I've got the chronology messed up in my notes. I hope I remember this correctly. No, this is, my notes are right. God there, Abimelech then, he responds then to the dream. And what he does, it says that he gets up early. Abimelech is eager to set things straight. He gets up early in the morning, he talks to his advisors, and he tells them what's happened and impresses upon them the urgency of the situation and the importance of the situation. And his advisors are impressed with the importance and urgency of the situation. They too are frightened. If you think back, the response of the fiancés of Lot's daughters, when Lot went and warned them of the impending judgment, they thought it was a joke. By contrast, here we have Abimelech taking this dream very seriously. And not only does Abimelech take this seriously, but his advisors take it seriously as well. So he calls in Abraham, and what he does is he castigates Abraham, and he says, what have you done? Abraham has acted certainly unkindly, if not foolishly, with respect to Abimelech. To allow Abimelech to think and encourage Abimelech to think that Sarah and Abraham are not married, and then to proceed accordingly. And Abimelech castigates Abraham for this, and he says, what have you done? You set things up so that I was committing adultery, essentially. You put things into place such that out of my ignorance, I was committing an evil act. How could you do that? Such things ought not be done. This is a pretty significant reprimand on the part of Abimelech, and justifiably so. Then he ends with a rather cryptic comment, and I'm not sure exactly what to make of it. In verse 10, What have you encountered, or the Hebrew word is see, what have you seen that you have done this? Well, Abraham has seen a lot. Abraham has been living in Canaan for 25 years, and he obviously has seen a lot. He has seen a lot of the wickedness of man. He's living near Sodom and has observed Sodom enough to know that it is a wicked place. We know that he knows it was a wicked place because of the way he responded when he, after he had defeated the four kings and returned, he did not want the king of Sodom to take any credit for his own wealth. So Abraham has seen a lot. He has probably seen a lot of lawlessness and a lot of evil. But what Abraham is forgetting here is he has also seen a lot of God's divine protection of him. Abraham has focused on one part of his experience, but has pushed under the rug of forgetfulness another part of his experience. And that other part of his experience is God has been very faithful to Abraham. God has gotten Abraham out of a number of jams, and Abraham has forgotten that. So Abimelech's words, I think, are very appropriate to Abraham, things that he needed to hear. Abraham then responds, and he justifies what he did by saying, you know, there are a lot of bad people around here. The people around here do not fear God, and therefore one can only expect from them evil and lawlessness. And I was afraid that I might be killed. So that's his basic defense. His secondary defense is, and besides, she is my sister. That's, as I mentioned when I was talking about the same event in Egypt, that's a Clinton-esque kind of approach to it. It was designed, the statement was designed to deceive. It may be true, but it's designed to give a false impression, nevertheless. And then the third part of his defense is, it's standard procedure. And this is kind of interesting. He explains that right from the very beginning, when they first came out to this lawless place, and it says, when we left the home of my father. It's not clear to me whether that's talking about Ur, way back in Mesopotamia, or whether he's talking about Haran, because Abram left Ur, moved to Haran, and lived there for a while, before then proceeding on to Palestine. I'm not sure whether he's talking about Ur or whether he's talking about Haran. Ur would have been the most civilized place in the world. Haran would have been an outpost, but still there would have been a lot of civility and law and order in Haran. But in any case, he's going from those relatively civilized places out into the wilderness, where there is very little law and order. And what they decide, what Abraham decides, is we need to have a consistent strategy here. Whenever we head into dangerous places, Sarah, you say that you are my sister, and I will say that I am your brother, and that way they won't kill me to get you. So that's the standard procedure that they've put into place, that they have continued to practice for at least 25 years. So his defense seems to be, one, there are lots of bad people out here. Two, and besides, she really is my sister. And three, that has been our standard operating mode of operation. In response then, Abimelech treats Abraham very graciously. He gives him animals, servants, and apparently money in addition. He restores Sarah to Abraham as his wife, and furthermore, he asks Abraham to settle in the land. So that's apparently a change in status. He is inviting Abraham to have a change in status from one who is sojourning here to someone who is living here as a resident, as one with legal status. And in response to that, then, Abraham prays for Abimelech, and Abimelech and his household are all healed, as God had said would happen. Okay, there are two things here that I'd like to look at in particular. One is, once again, we have a sojourner, the treatment of a sojourner at the hands of a society. Here in particular, it's Abimelech. And notice that Abimelech's response to what's happening here is significantly different than the response that we had seen from Pharaoh 25 years earlier. Pharaoh, it appears, did not want to get punished. When Pharaoh had the plague put on him as a result of the fact that he had taken in Sarah as his wife, the impression you get from the text is that Pharaoh just wants to be rid of all of this. He doesn't want the plague. He wants to be relieved of that. And so he gives Sarah back to Abraham and sends them on their way. Abimelech is different. Abimelech, first of all, argues his innocence in his case before God. And then secondly, he asks Abraham to stay and settle here. Abimelech is truly recognizing Abraham's status as prophet of God, the God who is, and wants to be an ally of Abraham rather than kicking him out of the land. So I think we see in Abimelech a whole different spirit than what we saw in Pharaoh. That it is true, it is genuinely true that Abimelech acted with a pure heart and clean hands. He has a pure heart before God and wants to be accepting of the people that God sends his way, and those who are representatives of God. Once again here, God is showing that he does not punish the righteous. He is not punishing Abimelech here. And one barometer of this kind of righteousness, this purity of heart, is how does a person respond to the disadvantaged, here in this case the traveler. But another barometer of the purity of one's heart is how do they respond to the ones that God sends, to his prophets. And we see here that he responds positively to Abraham. One of the interesting things that we see here is that although the narrative is going along following a certain line of descent, and in particular, we're following Abraham and his descendants through Isaac. That's what the author of Genesis is interested in charting out for us. This is the thread through history that's really important to him. Nevertheless, that does not mean that God is inactive elsewhere. We've already seen the mysterious character Melchizedek, someone who kind of comes out of nowhere but is nevertheless apparently a true worshiper of the God who is, of Yahweh. And here again we see an individual, Abimelech, who we don't know anything about where he comes from. We don't hear anything about him. Well, we hear something next chapter, but after that we don't hear any more about him. But nevertheless, here's another individual in whom God seems to be at work. And that's a helpful reminder, I think. We need to keep it in perspective. The author of Genesis is following the line of Abraham and his descendants for his purposes. But that does not mean that God is not at work elsewhere while all of this is going on. God truly is. Okay, now what should we think about Abraham and what he did here? As I've pointed out, this event is very similar to what happened in Egypt 25 years earlier. Very similar in the way that Abraham acts. The problem is, 25 years ago, he hadn't had much experience with God. Now, 25 years later, we've seen him in a number of different situations in which he has been able to see God's faithfulness to him. And yet, nevertheless, we see Abraham acting in a manner which is very unfaithful. He's not trusting God. He's relying on this strategy that they had devised many years earlier, and they're just carrying on with this strategy and counting on this strategy to protect them rather than God and his faithfulness. And on the one hand, this seems absolutely inexcusable. I can say that because I'm not Abraham. However, it's really clear that that kind of, I'll talk about this next. I'll talk about this later. First of all, it's interesting that weaknesses in human beings are not eradicated quickly. Apparently, Abraham has some sort of weakness here that this particular situation plays into. And we saw him fail 25 years ago, and we see him fail again. That means more than two decades have passed, and this weakness has not been eradicated from his life. What's helpful about this is we need to understand that who we are runs deep, and the weaknesses that are in us run deep as well. And those weaknesses are only rooted out over long periods of time. We're talking decades rather than weeks, if at all. We will die with weaknesses still in place. So to the extent that God is working in our lives and changing us, and is overcoming those weaknesses in our lives, that is a long-term project. And it's really important to keep that in mind, both with respect to ourselves as well as with respect to others. We need to grant them patience as God works on his own timetable to bring about those changes. God is committed to changing his people, but he's not committed to changing them instantly. Those things take time. And to see a person fail in a certain area and then later fail in the same area, that ought not shock us. And it ought not be a reason for us to cease being patient with them. We should expect that, because those weaknesses run so deeply. Secondly, it's important to note that things like bravery come in all kinds. There isn't just bravery, there are kinds of bravery. Notice that Abraham was very brave when he took his little commando band chasing after the four kings from the east who had come into Palestine, who had defeated all of the powers in Palestine, and then were going back to Mesopotamia. And he took his little commando band and went after them and defeated them. I think that's an indication of real bravery. But here in this situation, there's something about it. And it's not clear to me exactly what it is about this kind of situation, but it plays into Abraham's weaknesses. And with respect to this situation, he's a coward. But that shouldn't surprise us. You've probably all heard stories of men who are Green Berets or something, who when it comes to having blood drawn, pass out. I mean, there are different kinds of bravery. And that there are different kinds of bravery shouldn't surprise us, because there are different kinds of all kinds of things. There are different kinds of intelligence. One of the things that I have marveled at, both in homeschooling my own kids and then also teaching at Gutenberg, is the extent to which every single human being has a combination of strengths and weaknesses. And with respect to intelligence, there are certain areas in which a person will have outstanding intelligence, and another area in which their intelligence fails them. Doesn't work, and they just can't get certain things. We're all like that. We have different areas in which our intelligence is outstanding and other areas in which it's not so good. I've thought about myself with respect to interpersonal conflict. I don't like interpersonal conflict. But there's a sense in which I need to be more specific, because there are certain times when I consistently do not like the conflict, and there are other times when it doesn't bother me. And I cannot predict and tell you the variables that makes one okay with me and the other one not okay with me. But I have noticed that that is the fact. So all kinds of qualities that we have are very nuanced. And it's when a series of factors come together that some of our weaknesses become very pronounced. But likewise, you can have a number of factors come together in a different way in which our strengths take over. We're complex people with lots of different strengths and weaknesses. They aren't easily categorized. And that's not just true of us, but it's true of everyone around us. And then the third thing that I think is worthy of notice here. We all have very short memories. Abraham has a very short memory here. He should be able to remember back less than 1 year to the destruction of Sodom. He should be able to remember back a few more years than that to when God preserved him when he fought against the four kings of the east. He should have been able to remember back to just a few years before that when he divided land with Lot, and nevertheless, Abraham was blessed by God. He should be able to remember those things. But history tells us that we as human beings are very myopic. It's very difficult for us to see more than a day or two in the past, and we can't see into the future, so we focus on today. And by focusing on the day, we get things all out of perspective. We do it all the time. This is not just Abraham that does this. If you remember back to when we were going through the book of Exodus, one of the most aggravating things about the book of Exodus is you have God performing these plagues, which were earth-shaking events. The plagues that were inflicted upon Pharaoh and his people were made known to the whole world through the grapevine, if not other ways. Those were earth-shaking events, and yet, as you read the account of the Israelites marching through the desert, they forget. They forget all the time. They don't have a very long memory. They can't remember back to the plague. They can't remember back to what God has done for them. All they can focus on is, my plate is empty right now. And they can't keep things in perspective. Abraham does that. The children of Israel do that. And we do that. It's very difficult for us to have that sense of history that will carry us through. There, that sense of history is drawn upon in Psalm 105, where it refers, I think, to this specific event. Let me read for you, starting with verse 8 and ending with verse 15. This is all an account talking about God's love and faithfulness towards the people of Israel. And in verse 8 it says, starting in verse 8 of Psalm 105, He has remembered His covenant forever, the word which He commanded to 1,000 generations, the covenant which He made with Abraham, and His oath to Isaac. Then He confirmed it to Jacob for a statute, to Israel as an everlasting covenant, saying, To you I will give the land of Canaan as the portion of your inheritance. When they were only a few men in number, very few, and strangers in it. And they wandered about from nation to nation, from one kingdom to another people. He permitted no man to oppress them, and He reproved kings for their sake. Do not touch my anointed ones, and do my prophets no harm. The psalm then goes on. But I think that that psalm is referring specifically to these events here in Genesis. And the psalmist is looking back at these events and saying, this is proof of God's faithfulness to His people. But Abraham, in the midst of it, has trouble seeing the faithfulness of God to him. If he could just draw back and see things in perspective, it's very different. But we as human beings are very myopic. Okay. Questions, comments, microphone.
That was really good. And what I'm going to say here is not a disagreement with anything you said, but something you said got me thinking about this passage. Yeah, that's always dangerous. And it struck me, I don't know, I mean, this is just a thought that's occurring to me now, so I don't know how strongly I would hold to it, but it seems to me that maybe there's one other layer here to what's going on in this section as well. I mean, it goes along with everything you said, I think. But what struck me is Abraham has been told that within a year, his wife is going to give birth to a son. So in this situation, to allow her to go off with Abimelech, part of what it's doing, I mean, there's all kinds of implications there. It's like if God is really right about her being fertile, then if a son were to happen, it calls into question, like, who's the father?
Right.
I mean, if she's been off with Abimelech, right? I mean, this is right at the time when this stuff would be going on.
Absolutely.
And I think that's not an irrelevant consideration because so much in this section, in the Pharaoh section, Sarah is not vindicated in that story. We don't know whether she had relations with Pharaoh or not, if I remember correctly. Or am I not remembering?
I think we know that I don't know. I'd have to look back.
Okay, well, take that away. Maybe okay. I'll take that comment back. Okay. I'm just going from memory.
Right.
But in this account, a lot of emphasis is put on the fact that Abimelech did not approach her.
Right.
And I don't know what this phrase means, but in 16, to Sarah he said, Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, it is your vindication before all who are with you and before all men you are cleared. He's saying that to Sarah.
Yes.
It's almost like, I mean, one way of understanding that is saying, I'm giving you all this money, Sarah, and this is my way of saying, you didn't do anything. You have been faithful to your husband. You didn't do anything wrong, and you and I didn't do anything.
Right.
I mean,
right.
if that's the case, then it shows the magnitude of what Abraham did, because he has really put aside this great promise. He's totally forgotten about all of that stuff and really jeopardized the whole thing on the one hand, and yet the story goes to great lengths to indicate, basically to say, Isaac is not Abimelech's kid when this happens down the line.
Right, right. That's a good point. It's true.
I think Robbie went there.
I had a question about Abimelech. Mm-hmm. I mean, he seems like a good guy in that when God does come to him, he responds quickly. And yet he just took Sarah. I mean, whether or not she was Abraham's sister, I mean, in a sense, he treated a sojourner ill, and unless that was just a common cultural thing, but he did something against a sojourner, and that he just came and took somebody from their camp. And also when he asks Abraham, what did you see that made you think that you had to lie about this or to say this falsehood?
Right.
I mean, is he saying the fact that Abraham did that, is he looking at this particular culture, this particular kingdom, and seeing that it's not that it's a godless place, and then what does that say about Abimelech as the head of it? And in a sense, is Abimelech, I don't know if we go through conversion, but is in a sense he, when God comes to him and he responds, I mean, is that like an awakening for him? Or?
Well, the first one, I'm assuming that when he takes Sarah, I'm assuming that if we knew all of the circumstances, that this is not a, it's not being done by force. I'm inclined to think that it's probably an agreement that's being made, but it doesn't say so. So it's cryptic. It's hard to say. But he, in his defense of him, let's see, God does not accuse him of any wrongdoing with respect to that. So I'm assuming that what he does there is innocent. Now, Abraham's concerns, I think, are based on the area in general. I don't know if he has specific knowledge of Gerar, such that he is afraid going into Gerar. I'm assuming that Gerar, I see no reason to think that Gerar is particularly evil. Now, there's another part of your question. What was the other part of your question?
Yeah,
that could very well be. That it could very well be that there is something jolting about this that's awakening Abimelech, and that there is a kind of conversion thing happening. That's very possible, it seems to me. That it's hard to judge that, but he certainly responds positively. And whether he would have responded positively prior to this event is hard to know.
When it says that God opened the wombs of his wives and maids, discovering that you're fertile is something, or that you're infertile is not something that happens over, a week or two.
Right.
So I'm wondering if Abimelech was able to be sexual but had been wanting offspring and had been trying for a long time and had not succeeded, and his taking Sarah is another attempt of, well, all the women I've chosen so far don't seem to be able to produce an heir for me, so let's try another one. And then he discovers he himself is not able to perform with this particular one, and that's when God contacts him and he gives Sarah back, and then he says he opens up, he restores everybody then, and presumably add offspring. And doesn't Abimelech's name mean father of a king?
Yes.
So maybe I believe I've heard that sometimes people get named for things that are significant about them. And I don't know, maybe his name wasn't Abimelech at the time, but his name, the Bible is referring to him as Abimelech as evidence of the fact that he was finally able to have offspring.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Make sense?
Mm-hmm. I was trying to figure out what could be happening that can be described by their wombs being closed, and how that could be found out in such a short period of time and all that sort of thing. And your solution is good. I mean, that's possible.
You've helped me a lot in understanding Abimelech. That makes a lot of sense, the stuff you were suggesting about his response to God and his contrast with Pharaoh and the sons-in-law and everything. That's very, very helpful. The part that I'm confused about is what was the crux of your message, and that is the cowardice of Abraham. I'm not convinced of that, and it seems to me an important issue, because we have to decide what it means to live by faith. And I don't think I'm convinced that Abraham was not being faithful here, was not being trusting. Your premise is that he did what he did out of cowardice, just because he did it. But why didn't his action represent rationality rather than cowardice? For example, if I go to a doctor and I have this prognosis that I'm going to die, but they try some kind of medication, some kind of medical treatment, and God in his grace spares me, does that mean that next time I'm in a similar situation, I shouldn't go to the doctor because God spared me? I don't think so, because I'm just living my life rationally. But at the same time that I'm living my life rationally, I can be assuming that God in his grace will either bless me or not. God must take care of me. God must protect me. So the fact that God spared him in Egypt, I don't think would necessarily translate into next time I'm going to tell the truth and not use the same strategy. But rather, he may have been very, very trusting of God in the midst of this. Yeah, there's going to be a while where I'll be separated from Sarah and she'll be put in his harem, but God will take care of it. And the thing that's interesting about the text is you never have any rebuke by God to Abraham, I don't think. Abimelech rebukes him, but Abimelech's upset. It seems to me that we don't really have any rebuke by God. Rather, God turns around, and just as he did in Egypt, Abraham comes out a much wealthier man after this than he was before. Mm-hmm. Wealthier, more powerful. God has blessed him again. So I don't have any problem with Abraham being weak. I don't have any problem with him being unfaithful. And everything you said about that makes a ton of sense, I think, is really right. I'm just not sure that Abraham hasn't learned his lesson. I'm not sure that he's not acting in faith. And is there anything I'm missing, or?
Well, I guess the question would be, certainly it makes sense to act rationally. But just because something makes a particular strategy makes sense and will work doesn't mean that it's one that we ought to employ. And the question here is this a strategy that is consistent with God's values?
Well, yeah. That's why this is an important question for me, because it seems exactly analogous to the SS guy knocking on the door saying, "Are you hiding any Jews in here?"
Mm-hmm.
My ethical evaluation of that is, it would be highly immoral for me to say, "I cannot tell a lie, they're in the attic."
Mm-hmm.
That would be an incredibly immoral action, not a moral action. Truth in that situation is a crazy immoral thing to do. Deception in human relationships is evil, but it's far more evil to be to be asked by somebody, will you cooperate with me in this horrendous and outrageous evil, and for me to say, well, okay, I will. That's my evaluation of that kind of scenario, and it seems to me that this one is comparable, because I think Abraham is right. I mean, I don't know how to interpret the idea that they, if Abraham is voluntarily giving Sarah to Abimelech, then why doesn't, as Abimelech comes to Abraham and says, can I marry your sister, Abraham doesn't at that point say, well, actually, she's my wife, so the answer is no, unless there's a danger of them saying, well, we can fix that. Mm-hmm. We can make her a widow. There's got to be some coercion going on here that at least he's afraid of. Now, maybe Abimelech is righteous enough that Abimelech is sort of hurt that he would think he's in that category, but it's not crazy for Abraham. It just seems incredibly rational on his part to say, well, I'm Abraham and this is my sister. Because they are prepared to make her a widow if you say, this is my husband, and go back to the king and say, we found this widow wandering around the desert. It just seems to me that that's the scenario he's confronting, and that rather than it being cowardice and a lack of trust and lack of integrity, I think he's doing the best he can in an incredibly evil world and an incredibly evil situation.
There's a lot that I would agree with in what you're saying. It is curious to me that what he's concerned about is his own self-preservation. Does he say it in here? Where he talks about the strategy, yes. And Abraham said, because I thought surely there is no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. There's something strange about that preoccupation with self-preservation. That's what makes it different from the Jews in my attic, that they're the ones that are at risk as a result of what I say. But here, it's he is the one that's at risk. I still have difficulty seeing this as Abraham choosing the right and wise course of action under these particular circumstances. We've got three people. It doesn't matter. We got three people.
I don't know whether what Abraham did was right or not, or whether he was trusting God or not. But what's interesting to me is this view of history that is presented in this passage, and that is that regardless of whether Abraham, I don't know whether Abraham was aware of God's workings sort of behind the scenes, but if this history wasn't found in the scriptures, I suspect that it would be very different. It would be reported very differently, and that we wouldn't have this understanding of God speaking to Abimelech, or God healing Abimelech, or all this stuff going on underneath or behind the scenes, in a sense. And right. I think that is comforting to me. And I think it applies to how we think about what God is doing, not just back then, but even now.
Mm-hmm. It is difficult as we live life to see it with the clarity that it's presented here. It is very helpful to have the divine commentary that helps give significance for different things, but otherwise, right? Right. Right.
I don't know if I should say anything. I guess just, Jack, what you said really upset me. I respect you immensely, but I don't understand. It's like, to me, it is so glaringly, outrageously apparent for Abraham to do what he did. He utterly betrayed Sarah to save his own skin. I don't understand how that isn't compelling to you, that what he did was utterly and totally cowardly. I'm sorry, I probably shouldn't be saying anything, but I'm just really upset. I don't understand how you can't see that. I find what David is saying so compelling, and in my own life, just the analogy of how profoundly and deeply sinful we are to turn around and do the same thing 25 years later is the hallmark of my life. You know, it's just, I don't know. I just find what he's saying so compelling, and I don't understand your position. So maybe you could explain to me, or not, why you aren't compelled by Abraham's abandoning his husbandship to his wife.
Maybe Jack.
Well, yes, Abraham is concerned about his own safety, but that's because he's helpless to protect Sarah. The king is going to do with Sarah whatever he's going to do with Sarah, whether he's dead or alive. So I think it mischaracterizes it to say that he's sacrificing Sarah to save his own skin. I don't think that's true. We ought not to live in a world where bandits can come and take whatever they want whenever they want it. We ought not to live in that kind of world. But to the extent that people victimize us in that way, we're at the mercy of God one way or the other. I think Abraham understands that. But he can either be at the mercy of God and alive, or he can be at the mercy of God and dead. And Abraham sees it, deems it as in light of the promises of God and other experiences, he deems it as wise to try to act in such a way that he can buy himself some time and stay alive and watch God work, watch God protect them both, Sarah included. I don't think it's a betrayal of Sarah. I think to characterize it that way is to misunderstand what's going on here. But that's the thing I'm concerned about, is that we not pit trusting God against acting wisely, rationally, prudently. I don't think they're in conflict with each other. I think simply by taking this, if God comes along and says, don't take action, trust me, then it would be untrusting and cowardly and unfaithful of me to disobey God and do what I think is rational rather than trust God. But most of life does not pit us with that kind of choice. In most of life, I simply need to do what I think is prudent all the time, knowing that all the prudence in the world is not going to protect me if God does not bless me. And so I can trust God simultaneously with acting prudently. I'm just not clear that that's not the way to interpret what Abraham is doing here, as he's doing both. He is trusting God, and he's acting in a way that's prudent in the midst of a morally murky situation, the Wild West, where there's bandits who take the law in their own hands and think they're answerable to nobody.
Is it possible we're overlooking or unaware of some of the a cultural manifesto in marriage here? And he mentioned about Abraham becoming Sarah becoming a widow. If a man comes into a culture that has certain rules, that even though we may see them as barbaric or they may be a sinful culture, they are at least inherent in internally coherent in their rules. A man comes in with a wife and they arrange his death, and now there's this unowned woman which anyone can claim. A man comes into a culture as the brother to an unmarried woman. She is under his authority, under his ownership, so to speak, and to get her, the people within that culture may have to bribe him. You know, I want permission to marry your sister. Here, I'm going to give you some cattle, some sheep, some land, some, you know, pretty soon here I'm going to wear you down and you're going to give me the blessing. Because if I just take her outright, I'll lose my status among my own people. I mean, I've read of these types of arrangements and cultures, you know, National Geographic and in anthropological studies and whatnot, some very weird arrangements over, quote unquote, who owns women, who has the right to give her away, who has the right to join to her. If Abraham came into a culture like that, it wouldn't be a stupid thing to say, let's go as brother and sister. That'll keep me alive until we can come up with something better, like Jack says. If doing that does not give her over to violence, then I don't see anything wrong with it. As opposed to, this is my wife, and some clown can now stand up and challenge me for her and kill me for her, and even his own culture will approve of it. I mean, could that be possible? Is that something we're overlooking?
Well, it would be very helpful to know more of what the cultural assumptions are and what the expectations are. That would all be very, very helpful. But in the absence of that information, we just go with what we can in the text. I don't know. I don't know what else. I need to think about it some more. And we don't have time. We have run over time. It's an interesting problem to resolve. Very quickly, we are out of time. There have been a couple of people during the week that have asked me if we could spend a Sunday talking about the events of the last week. If we were to put together an in-house panel of people, and I don't even know who would be on that yet, would people be interested in spending a week just talking about the terrorist bombing and the implications of that? Just a show of hands, how many would like to spend a Sunday doing that kind of thing? Okay, well, I will see what I can put together for next week. Thanks.